You know, when you think about how populations change, biological populations, it's really easy to just focus on the numbers, right? How many are there now versus later?
Sure, that's the basic ecological view.
But it's so much deeper than that, isn't it? It's about the history woven through them. It's fundamentally about who is related to whom, you know, the hidden family tree.
Exactly, the ancestry, the genealogy,
Yeah.
that's often crucial.
And yeah, traditional models, the mathematical ones, they've been amazing tools, no doubt. But, well, they often simplify things, sometimes maybe too much.
That's a fair point. Especially when they average things out, they can lose that really fine-grained detail about individual relationships, the actual ancestry links.
So today we're doing a deep dive into a paper that tackles this head-on. It's called Genealogical Constructions of Population Models. The authors are Allison Etheridge and Thomas Kurtz.
Ah, yes, that's a significant one. They propose a really quite innovative way to look at this.
Yeah, it seems like they've found a way to build these models and keep that family tree structure intact, which sounds, well, pretty challenging.
It is.
Okay, so let's try and unpack this. Our mission here, for you listening, is to get our heads around this framework. It sounds powerful, maybe a bit counterintuitive.
Possibly at first glance.
Well, we want to dig into the core ideas they talk about: particles, types, levels, and something called the look-down construction,
That's central.
and figure out why this approach is actually such a potent tool,
No.
you know, for researchers studying anything from, say, how diseases move through related groups to understanding the history buried in our genes. It's about finding those maybe surprising insights you miss with the simpler views.
Right. So maybe we should start with the standard ways people model populations. There are sort of two main camps.
Okay.
You've got the ecological models. They're mostly about the numbers, like you said. Population size, births, deaths, interactions, environmental factors.
Predator-prey cycles, competition, that kind of
Ah,
thing. Yeah.
exactly. Big picture dynamics. Then you have the population genetics models.
Right, focused on the genes.
Yeah, tracking genetic traits, alleles, mutations, selection, how gene frequencies change over generations. And often they work backwards from the genetic data we see today to figure out, what the likely ancestral patterns were. They infer genealogies.
But they might not explicitly model all the messy ecological stuff happening at the same time.
Often no. Or they simplify it. And here's the catch, especially when people take these models, either type, really, and try to simplify them for, say, very large populations, they often use something called diffusion limits.
For fusion limits. Okay, what happens there?
Well, these approximations are they're mathematically convenient. They capture the broad strokes really well, like how the overall frequency of a gene variant changes across the whole population.
Sounds useful.
It is. But the cost is often losing the individuals. The specific identities of who descended from whom, that intricate web of the genealogical tree connecting everyone, that detailed history tends to get, well, averaged out. It essentially vanishes in the math.
Huh. So, how big a deal is that? Losing the family tree, I mean. Does it always matter? Or are there questions where it just makes things impossible?
That's a great question. I mean, look, if all you want is a rough prediction of, say, a common gene's frequency next year in a huge, thoroughly mixed population, maybe you don't need the exact tree.
Okay.
But if you want to understand why you see a certain pattern today, or trace how a specific new mutation spread, or figure out how geography affects who's related to whom nearby,
Ah, okay. Then you need the history.
then you absolutely need the history. Losing the tree means you're missing a huge chunk of the explanation. It's like trying to understand a family saga by only knowing the total number of descendants.
Right, you lose all the interesting stories. So this Etheridge and Kurtz paper steps in here. They propose a new way to represent the population, one that doesn't throw the history away. It starts with particles.
Exactly. They think of the population as a collection, a system of particles. Each particle is basically an individual.
Okay, simple enough.
And each particle has a type. Now, type here isn't just its genes. It usually includes more. Typically, its spatial location plus its genetic makeup.
So where it is and what it is genetically.
Precisely. And then comes the real innovation, which builds on some earlier work, particularly by Donnelly and Kurtz themselves. They assign a unique level to every single particle.
A level, like a number.
Yeah, usually a non-negative number, could be an integer or a real value. But the key thing, the absolutely crucial part of their construction, is that no two individuals existing at the same time have the exact same level. Each one gets a unique spot, level-wise.
A unique level for everyone, like a unique ID number, but maybe more structured. How does just giving everyone a number help keep track of who's related to whom? That feels like the missing piece.
Right, it's not just a label, that's the clever bit. These levels aren't static. They evolve, and they're assigned and managed in a very specific way that actually encodes the relationships. Think of it maybe like the levels give each individual a persistent coordinate in a kind of abstract space.
Okay.
And it's how these levels are structured and how they change over time through birth and death events that allows this system to maintain the genealogical links. It's completely different from the diffusion limits where individual identities just dissolve. These levels provide the anchor.
Okay, I think I'm starting to see. And the main mechanism they use for this, for actually building and maintaining these genealogies using the levels, is this look-down construction. It's a funny name. Why look down?
Yeah. It sounds a bit odd, but it describes the process perfectly. Imagine a new individual is born. So a new particle appears in the system. It gets inserted at a particular level. Now, to figure out who its parent is, this new particle essentially looks down from its level through all the particles currently existing at lower levels.
It scans downwards.
Exactly. And based on specific rules defined by the particular model you're building, the first particle it sees or encounters as it looks down is designated as its parent.
So the connection, the parent-offspring link, is made by this looking down process based on the levels.
Precisely. It's this look down rule for generating new individuals and linking them to parents that is the, well, the mechanical heart of the whole thing. It ensures that as the population changes, individuals die, new ones are born, levels evolve, the parent-offspring connections, and therefore the entire genealogical tree structure remain explicitly represented and traceable within the system.
Which is exactly what gets lost in those other approximations.
Right. The links aren't just implicitly there and then averaged out. They're actively constructed and maintained by this level and look-down system.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting for me. The paper argues you can take all the complex things that happen in real populations, you know, births, deaths, moving around, genes changing, competing.
All the demographic process.
Yeah. And you can break them down into a set of like fundamental building blocks, simple components, or generators, as they call them.
That's right. Like Lego bricks for population dynamics.
Exactly. And section 3 lists a whole bunch of these, like just individuals dying off pure death or multiple individuals dying together. Sudden bursts of births, continuous birth rates.
Then there's one-for-one replacement where a birth causes a death, keeping the size constant.
Right, or random removal thinning, immigration from outside. Mm-hmm. And then different ways individuals can move or change independently or interacting with each other.
Yeah, like spatial movement or mutation.
Can we walk through a simple one just to see how it works with the particles and levels? Maybe that pure death process from section 3.1.
Sure, good idea. So in a really basic model, you just have a rate, right? A chance per unit time that any individual dies. In this particle level framework, it's represented differently. Each individual particle has its unique level. And that level isn't necessarily fixed. It can change over time. For a pure death process, you might imagine each individual's level continuously increasing.
Like a clock ticking up for each person.
Sort of, yeah. And there's a set threshold, maybe an upper boundary. When an individual's level crosses that threshold, poof, that event is its death. It's removed from the active population.
So death isn't just a random deletion. It's tied to the dynamics of this unique level associated with the individual.
Exactly. And that's the power. Even a simple event like death becomes part of this system that inherently keeps track of individuals via their levels, the same levels that define the genealogy through the look-down process. It makes the whole thing modular and keeps the history.
Okay, that makes sense. And the real payoff then is that you take these modular history tracking building blocks and you combine them using that look-down construction. And by doing that, you can actually build sophisticated models that people already use, but now with the genealogy built right in.
Precisely.
Yeah.
That's what Section 4 is all about. They show how you can combine these components to construct things like the spatial Lambda-Fleming-Viet process.
Okay, what's that model for?
That describes populations spread out in space, where reproduction and death can happen in sort of bursts locally, affecting multiple individuals. It's pretty complex.
Right.
They also build spatially interacting Moran models. Those are often used for populations where the size is fixed, maybe due to limited space or resources, so every birth has to be balanced by a death. Think competition on a grid.
Like modeling cells in a tissue, maybe?
Could be, yeah. Or species competing in a habitat. They can also construct classic branching processes good for modeling populations that grow or shrink exponentially.
Yeah.
And even the voter model,
the voter model that's used for opinion dynamics, right? Yeah. Or ecological succession.
Exactly. How local interactions lead to large-scale patterns, like everyone eventually agreeing or one species taking over.
And the key insight is because they built these using the look-down and levels.
They can now study the genealogies inside these models. That wasn't easy, or sometimes even possible, before.
So you could ask new questions within those existing models.
Definitely. Take that spatial Moran model on a grid. You can now ask, using this framework, if I pick two individuals right next to each other, how far back, on average, do I have to go to find their common ancestor? And how does that compare to two individuals on opposite sides of the grid? The level system lets you track the lineages needed to answer that, embedded within the standard Moran dynamics.
Okay, that adds a whole new dimension. So let's bring it back to the listener. Why should you, listening now, care about all this talk of particles, levels, look-down constructions? I mean, unless you're actually building these models.
Well, I think it matters because this framework offers a more unified and arguably more realistic way to think about populations. It lets us properly integrate the where and how many, the ecological side, with the who came from whom, the genetic history side.
Instead of having them in separate boxes.
Exactly. And crucially, it does this without losing that vital information about ancestry. That ability to keep the tree is, well, it's fundamental if you want the full picture.
So it helps us understand evolution better.
Absolutely. Evolution in space and time. It's also super important for making sense of real-world genetic data. You know, you sequence some DNA from a population.
Yeah.
This kind of framework can help you work backward and figure out the most likely historical process. The births, deaths, movements, the whole ancestral branching that could have produced the genetic patterns you see today. Section 3.0 touches on sampling from these processes.
So connecting models directly to data analysis.
Right. And potentially you could apply it to things like disease spread, where maybe close relatives are more likely to infect each other, or even how cultural traits pass down through social networks where ancestry matters. Mm-hmm. It just gives you a richer, more detailed lens.
Okay. So summing up this deep dive, this Etheridge and Kurtz paper lays out a really powerful, flexible way to model all sorts of population dynamics. It uses this clever system of particles, unique levels, and the look-down construction.
Mm.
And the big win is that it seamlessly blends the ecological factors with the genetic history. And crucially, it preserves the genealogical information, the family tree that often gets lost.
Yeah, that's the core takeaway.
Which gives us tools for a much deeper, more nuanced understanding than we could get from models that ignore or average out that history.
Well said. And maybe here's a final thought, something for you to mull over.
Okay.
Think about patterns you see out there in the biological world. Genetic variation between groups, maybe how a disease is clustered, even how different species are arranged in an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that pattern is because of what's happening right now, current environment, current interactions, versus how much is actually an echo of the past? A consequence of deep historical connections, shared ancestry, the shape of that underlying genealogical tree that we can now actually model explicitly using this kind of approach. Are we seeing the present, or are we seeing layers of history? This framework gives us better tools to start asking that question seriously.
A lot to think about there. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.